I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. One executive is out. More are expected to follow today after J.P. Morgan's $2 billion loss last week, which won't topple that huge bank, but has made a big dent in its call for less regulation. Today it was announced that Ina Drew, the head of the unit responsible for the trading blunder and one of the most successful women on Wall Street, will retire. Meanwhile, J.P. Morgan's CEO, Jamie Dimon, faces shareholders at that company's annual meeting tomorrow. He was known as Wall Street's best risk manager, according to the New York Times, the most influential voice against regulations. But Bloomberg News is reporting today that it was Dimon that pushed Ina Drew's unit into making riskier investments. Bloomberg News reporter Brad Cowan joins us. And Brad, this can get netty, but we understand Drew's unit's job was to invest the depositor money that hadn't yet been lent out. And Bloomberg talked to a former J.P. Morgan worker who said he was told, "We want more profits from that unit."
Well, that is true. J.P. Morgan had this special division, and it had a couple responsibilities. One was definitely if the bank had some deposits and was not using those deposits to make loans, so it just had the cash sitting around, it could take that cash and invest it in, you know, treasury securities, mortgage-backed securities that are backed by government-sponsored agencies, or they could put it in corporate bonds or other riskier investments. And that does appear to be the direction that J.P. Morgan pushed in the past couple years.
Well, and according to this former J.P. Morgan worker, this was a directive from the new CEO, Jamie Dimon.
That's true. It was done with a few people who were down in this division, but it was certainly done with the blessing of Jamie Dimon.
Well, and how does that square with what he's now saying, that these were stupid mistakes made by this unit?
Probably the distinction is between the broader strategy of wanting to push into investments that may carry just a little bit more risk, which means they may actually bring a little bit more profit, and having that broad strategy versus, okay, how are we actually going to do this? It just got too complicated, too complex. And so now Jamie is saying, look, the people who actually went forward and implemented the strategy just did a horrible job of it.
Well, but some of those people include Bruno Ixel, who's the London trader, who's been called the London Whale, and Voldemort, you know, because of all these huge investments he was making. Bloomberg saying that, you know, his office doesn't even seem to understand what was happening. Jamie Dimon didn't understand. So doesn't this just play right into the call for more transparency, more regulation, and the Volcker rule, which is in the Frank Dodd bill that hasn't even been enacted yet?
Well, it certainly does. I mean, Jamie Dimon, more than any other executive on Wall Street, was viewed as probably the one CEO who really did appear to have it all under control. He, as CEO, managed their bank through the financial crisis of 2008-2009 better than any other of his peers, and they have this mantra that they have the fortress balance sheet, which means that they're stronger than all the other banks. And furthermore, Jamie Dimon has a reputation of a real hands-on manager, someone who really gets involved in the details. And so he had really taken a leadership role with the regulators. So if he was sort of the example of the one guy who could do it, that argument is looking a lot harder to make today.
This will play out on the campaign trail. Mitt Romney has called for repealing Dodd-Frank and the Volcker rule, which is under Dodd-Frank. Meanwhile, just, you know, the Volcker rule, named after Paul Volcker, would call for what?
Well, that would call for banning what is known as proprietary trading at banks that are part of the FDIC insurance scheme. And the idea is that if we have this government-sponsored program, the FDIC insurance deposit insurance program, that is essentially backing these banks, then we don't want the banks to be taking, you know, risky bets with their money, so that, you know, if the bets go right, they'll make a ton of money, they'll pay themselves huge bonuses, and then if the bets go bad, then the government is and the taxpayers are going to end up picking up the bill. So that is really what that is designed to do, is ban what's called proprietary trading, which is when the banks just go out and make bets with their own money.
Without, first of all, having the cash to back them up, which isn't the case with J.P. Morgan. They're incredibly healthy. They have tons of capital. This is more about the question of how much more of this is going on, maybe with banks that aren't as healthy. What else do you see happening this week? Is this the kind of thing that's just going to dissipate by the end of the week? Or is this knocking out the biggest voice against the Volcker Rule and it might finally get some legs?
The regulators are really full bore in writing these rules. All the banks have been in a full-on campaign to water that down and push back. And now, I mean, we even had an interview this last week with the CEO of SunTrust, a bank in the South, who doesn't even do a lot of this risky business. But we were asking him what this would mean for the industry, and even he was saying it's a black eye. I mean, he's as far away from Wall Street as you can get, and even he was acknowledging that this would really crimp the financial industry's campaign to push back on some of these regulations.
Brad Cowan of Bloomberg News. Brad, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Did you see Will Ferrell, a guest hosting on Saturday Night Live? In his opening monologue, he struggles to express his feelings for his mom.
You went into a hospital building, right? A long time ago, and strange men pulled me out of your lady parts. Wait, that was bad. That's bad. That's bad. God, why is this so hard? Is it the piano? It's the piano, isn't it? The piano player is awful. I'm sorry about that, Mom. He's terrible. You know what? I'm just gonna think about all the things you did for me, Mom person. You made milk for me. Like the lady from the cover of the Time magazine.
The cover of Time magazine. It must have been great because everyone is talking about it. And the mom nonchalantly breastfeeding a very healthy-looking 3-year-old. But often overlooked in the brouhaha over that picture is the discussion inside the magazine about attachment parenting and its biggest champions, Dr. William Sears and his wife Martha, who wrote the baby book 20 years ago. Attachment parenting holds that the more time babies spend in their mom's arms, breastfeeding or in a sling or sleeping with their parents, the better adjusted the children will be. But does it also lead to helicopter parenting? And our next guest asks, what about the parents? What's best or even possible for them? We want to spend a few minutes on the subject of parenting today with Margaret Nelson, professor of sociology at Middlebury College in Vermont, author of Parenting Out of Control, Anxious Parents in Uncertain Times. Professor Nelson, Margaret, welcome.
Thank you.
And
good to be here.
We'll start by saying you are not a pediatrician, and we want to get some of the cultural aspects from your point of view in a couple minutes. But let's just start by laying out some of the science, because the Sears also say that, for instance, excessive crying can damage a child's brain. Now, this runs up against the thinking that allowing babies to cry for controlled periods makes them better sleepers. Time reports that the science shows allowing a baby to cry for a brief period of time will not cause brain damage. Also reports that researchers say that sharing a bed with a baby can sometimes be dangerous. But touch on the thing everyone is talking about because of that cover, the breastfeeding. You know, we know it's beneficial, but, what are you hearing about this, the age, going to older ages?
I'm clearly, as you said, I'm not a pediatrician. I'm a sociologist, so I have no specific expertise in the area of breastfeeding. I did consult with a colleague of mine, Jacqueline Wolf, who teaches at the Heritage College of Osteopathic Medicine in Ohio. And she says her research demonstrates that the longer you breastfeed, the better it is, both for mother and for baby. But I think, going back to the Time magazine cover, toddlers don't breastfeed standing on stools and pulling down their mother's shirts. I mean, toddlers are babies, and they curl up in their mother's lap. So some of the benefit is social. That picture obviously did not convey how it is children normally breastfeed from their mothers.
Well, putting that picture aside, because we're going to, we'll just say that Time magazine finds that the American Academy of Pediatrics agrees frequency and duration are for mom and baby to determine. Everybody else probably should butt out. But, people are weighing in on the book and the theories behind the baby book because of the pressure it's perceived as putting on parents. Let's just talk through how Sears came to his thinking. He read the work of the father of attachment theory, who is a Brit named John Bowlby, who studied orphans with no parents at all, ever, and concluded they were less well-adjusted than parented kids. And then Bill Sears read a book called The Continuum Concept. This was written by a woman who observed indigenous people in Venezuela and concluded that babies are better off if you carry them in slings all the time. They're better behaved. Your thoughts on you know, kind of this look back and compilation of research to come up with this current thinking of the attachment theory?
Well, once again, I mean, it's not my particular area of expertise, and I can address some other issues later on. But it does seem to me that the bigger question is, why has that become so attractive right. to so many parents, rather than whether this is the best parenting practice, who in fact is attracted to the idea that their baby should be attached to them all the time, that they should be breastfeeding all the time, and that they should never ignore a cry or a whimper on the part of their babies.
Well, Judith Warner and others agree with you that parenting theories in the U.S. have always been in these pendulum swings. There was, in the early 1900s, James Watson, who told parents, you know, don't even kiss your child, shake their hand. And then Dr. Spock came along and said, you know what to do, and you know how to be loving to your child. And then we have, you know, now attachment parenting. What is it reflecting for you?
I think for me what it's really reflecting right now is that there's a lot of cultural anxiety about the fact that women are in the labor force. There has been for some time. There's lots of cultural anxiety about what happens when mothers are away from their children. And I think that there's also a group of parents who are terribly anxious about the future of their children and desperate to find anything that's likely to secure their success down the line. I think when we think about attachment parenting, one of the first things we have to say about it is it's not possible for most parents. I mean, most people cannot wear their babies all the time. If you're serving hamburgers at McDonald's, I think you're unlikely to be able to wear your baby as you do that kind of work. So we have to recognize that there's a certain social class who could even conceivably be attracted to or enact this kind of parenting style.
Margaret Nelson, professor of sociology at Middlebury College and author of Parenting Out of Control, Anxious Parents in Uncertain Times. We were prompted to do this by the Time magazine cover about attachment parenting, which holds that the more time babies spend in their mother's arms, the better they will be. But Margaret, I was just before the break referring to consultants in New York who say they're coming across patients that have post-traumatic Sears disorder. That's exact name of it. This is named after the Dr. Sears and his wife Martha, who wrote the baby book, who are calling for this attachment parenting. You were saying that, you know, part of the problem with it is that it's impossible for so many people.
Well, the idea that you have to be always available to your parent, to your child, obviously is impossible for anybody who's working outside the home, and probably even for anybody who's working inside the home or anybody who has another child. So, it has to be people who, with some resources, even the Sears say that they were providing the resources for their daughters-in-law, I think it was, to stay home and take care of their children, and their sons are doctors.
And they subsidize this. They say,
right.
You know, we felt we should. Well, but, you know, and you say the same divide is happening in helicopter parenting. We want to get to that, but, you know, talking about how these pendulum swings in child care happen, you said there's a lot of unease about, you know, women going into the workforce. Some people felt that the Sears had an agenda here because before they wrote the baby book, they wrote an evangelical version in which they questioned whether a mother should go back to work. They said that's not God's design. And then the Sears have also talked about their past history. He was abandoned by his father when he was an infant. His wife had a mentally ill mother and her father drowned. And his wife, Martha, has said, you could say I'm reacting to my own background, feelings of abandonment, when I say don't let a child cry themselves to sleep, which is part of their thinking. You know, so how much does parenting become, you know, maybe overcompensating for what you didn't have as a child?
Well, I would be hesitant to comment about the Sears. I mean, I think they're doing what they're doing. I think the more interesting question is, how come their book has gotten so much attention?
Right.
And why is it that there is a group of parents who think that this is what they might be doing with their children? And I guess one thing I'd say is, you know, this is a country that does not support mothers. This is a country that does not allow maternity leave. This is a country that makes it very difficult for women to work outside the home and to parent their children however they want to do it. So I think there is a group of women who probably got pushed out of very high status jobs because they couldn't both parent and be workers. Pamela Stone's work on opting out discusses that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And when these, many of them professional women, many of them highly educated women, go home, well, they find it, they use the same skills in parenting that they were using outside the home. So they go into parenting with a vengeance.
Mm-hmm. Well, and now switch to helicopter parenting, which you write about and which is, you know, with older children. Is that a natural extension for some people of attachment parenting?
I would guess it's an extension. I actually don't use the term helicopter parenting. I use the term parenting out of control, but maybe the terminology matters less than that. I am describing a kind of intensive parenting that could grow out of attachment parenting, but need not. Mostly what I'm concerned with in my research is the fact that I think parents are very anxious about the future right now. I think that we live in a time of enormous economic uncertainty. And if you don't know what it is that's going to be able to make your child successful, the best strategy may be to stay very close and keep very attentive and to intervene when you suspect that a child may be going down the wrong path.
Well, and look, we mentioned that doctors in New York are saying they're seeing women just completely stressed out and exhausted from trying to do the attachment parenting. You write that you are worried about let's not call them helicopter parents, but parents who hover and maybe over-involved with their kids. You're talking about, you write about a mom who doesn't put a filter on the TV. She sits and watches with the kids and asks them what they're doing every second. And it's exhausting for parents who, in fact, are not having a life of their own. Tell us more about that and also about the class divide that you see.
Well, I do think, thanks for asking, I do think that this kind of parenting is exhausting. I think that it has consequences for people's relationships. But I also think it has consequences for our communities. I think that people who are focused on their own children are less likely to be more broadly involved in their communities as a whole. And I think in a time when the burdens of caring for families have been shifted back onto families, it's not surprising that people have picked up on that burden. But I think one of the consequences is that we have less time for other people, less time for our communities, less time for social action, and less time for social engagement in general. So I think that the consequences that I'm concerned about really have to do with parents rather than children. Children will be fine. Almost no matter what we do with children, they'll be fine. But some of these parents may be exhausted.
Well, and just to note it before we say goodbye, you say that parents who can afford to spend every second with their kids, maybe they're working full-time, not to say that some of the helicopter parents aren't also working, but they put the screens on their TV set. They're not sitting there monitoring what they watch. They find other ways to interact with their kids and aren't as exhausted about it.
I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah. Margaret Nelson, professor of sociology at Middlebury College, author of Parenting Out of Control, Anxious Parents in Uncertain Times. We'll tell you more about that at hereandnow.org. And Professor Nelson, come back and talk to us more about that in the future. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
In Greece, party leaders are back at the negotiating table today after failing to agree yesterday on a new coalition government. The national elections 8 days ago ended in a deadlock with no party winning enough seats to form a government. But the chances of forming a coalition are low now that one leftist party has pulled out of the talks. That brings Greece one step closer to new elections and casts serious doubt on its continued membership in the Euro currency union and the European Union as a whole. So what is the mood in Greece, which has endured some of the toughest austerity measures in Europe? The BBC's former Athens correspondent Richard Galpin went back to Greece to gauge the mood of the people.
I was based here during the heady days of the Athens Olympics in 2004 when the country was riding high, having pulled off a successful Games, albeit at a very high cost. Now, here in Athens, it feels so different. It's quite shocking seeing how run down some parts of the city are. Buildings covered in graffiti, others bearing the scars of riots, shops closed in some areas. And many Greeks have one thing on their mind, that is to get out of the country. Well, I'm inside a very old house here in the Plaka district of Athens, and this is being used as an exhibition centre. And with me is George Neris, who is the head of the arts production company Synthesis, which runs this and a whole network of artists. You are going to leave the country, you're going to move to the UK. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Unemployment now is at 20% or more. So one of the ways that you can do something about it is go someplace where there are jobs. So this way you decrease unemployment overnight and you go some other place where there are jobs and you start working, as simple as that.
Well, we're on our way to a town called Elefsina, just outside Athens, an industrial town which has been particularly hard hit by the acute economic downturn of the past few years. According to the latest national figures for unemployment, around about a quarter of the workforce have so far lost their jobs. For people under the age of 25, the situation is even worse. About 54% are without work.
In a cafe in the heart of Elefsina, I met up with Athanasios Zafiropoulos, an accountant. Last year, he, like so many others here, was sacked, his company slashing the workforce to survive the recession. Athanasios is married with two young children. He cannot find another job and says the unemployment benefit he receives from the state is nowhere near enough to support his family.
You can't get along with this. Only if you cut your real needs should be cut off.
As we spoke, an elderly woman approached us, begging for money to buy food.
This shouldn't happen here in Greece. All people at this age have worked and worked and worked and worked, and now they beg for one small bread.
Those cries for help grow more numerous every month as the unemployment figures continue to rise rapidly. Not surprising, then, that after 2 years of brutal cutbacks in jobs, wages and pensions, the mental health of the population is now suffering. Suicide is much more common. Aris Violatsis is a psychologist working for a helpline which receives calls from those thinking about taking their own lives.
I can tell you that in 2011, we had twice as many phone calls as in 2010, while in 2012, we see that we will go even higher than that. That's no good news.
And at the moment, there's very little to suggest the news is going to get better anytime soon. Instead, the pain being felt by the Greek population is likely to get even worse.
That report from the BBC's Richard Galpin in Greece. We've been dropping in on the big U.S. Senate races. Today we want to focus on the one in our own backyard, Massachusetts Republican Scott Brown against his probable opponent, the Democrat Elizabeth Warren. Remember, Scott Brown wrote a Tea Party wave to win the 2010 special election to fill that seat that had been held by the late Ted Kennedy. He won in part because he opposed President Obama's health care law, but now he has an adult daughter taking advantage of that law by remaining on his health care. And Elizabeth Warren, the Harvard professor and consumer advocate who came up with the idea for the new Federal Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, has been dogged lately by the question of why, at times during her academic career, she cited her very distant Cherokee heritage. Boston Globe columnist Joan Vanacki has been following all of this. And Joan, let's start with the Cherokee Indian heritage. You know, many voters are just getting to know Elizabeth Warren across the country. They may not have heard about this. You know, she does have a very distant Cherokee relative, but how has she handled these accusations that maybe she was using that to get, you know, sort of the benefits of minority status?
Well, I think the problem for her is that she's handled it not particularly deftly, or to be more blunt, pretty badly. Mm-hmm. She turned what could have been, you know, just sort of a simple, you know, Q&A into a two-week story that dragged on and in some degree is still dragging on, or Scott Brown's trying to make it drag on.
Right. Well, she said initially that she listed herself that way. Well, she didn't know that Harvard might have listed her that way, but she did list herself that way, I think, in the Law Review, because she wanted to meet people like herself, people from Oklahoma. But as you said, people still have questions. Do we know, by the way, before we move from this, do we know if she received any benefit from being listed as having Cherokee heritage?
No, we don't know. And Harvard Law School has said that that's had nothing to do with why they hired her, or that it was all about excellence. There's no reason to doubt that. But, I mean, what's so bad about saying that, you know, if you use the same old boy network, you get the same old boys? And if, you know, if a place, like, if an institution like Harvard Law, the University of Pennsylvania Law School, consults professional directories that have people listed in different ways, that they're still getting excellence, they're just getting people from more diverse backgrounds.
Yeah. And we asked if Elizabeth Warren had any benefits, you know, from listing herself this way. Some people are saying the institutions did because they were under pressure to show that they had more minorities, so she might have been used in that way. But that story's still, you know, settling down. Meanwhile, they both have such compelling personal stories. Scott Brown comes from an abusive family. He's written about his abuse also outside the family at a church camp. Elizabeth Warren from a very poor family in Oklahoma. But let's get to some of the issues that they are, you know, attacking each other with right now. Elizabeth Warren out with a new ad that's timely given the J.P. Morgan Chase news. It features President Obama. Let's listen to a little.
Elizabeth Warren, she's a janitor's daughter who has become one of the country's fiercest advocates for the middle class. She came up with an idea for a new independent agency that would have one simple overriding mission, standing up for consumers and middle class families.
The big banks tried to stop us, but that new agency
so
is already
So, Joan Vanacki, that is the image Elizabeth Warren wants people to have of her, that she's on the side of the little guy. Is that her challenge here, defining herself that way rather than allowing Scott Brown to do it?
Absolutely. You know that old line, if you don't paint the picture of who you are, your opponent is happy to do it. And this does give her an opportunity to start reminding people what got them so excited, or at least what got the liberal base so excited about her as the candidate.
Right.
That she was this, you know, heroine that took on Wall Street, that, you know, is calling for financial reform and can now say, look, it didn't work. Now, the downside to that is, why didn't it work? Democrats may be, you know, slightly responsible for that as well as Republicans, but she's going to try to put the focus on the Republicans and their efforts to kill financial reform.
Well, sure. I mean, I'm hearing one challenge now just listening to that ad. Barack Obama was, you know, rebuked by her supporters for not allowing her or pushing her to be the head of that agency that she created, and now they're standing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, he did blink in the face of opposition to her being, you know, in charge of the agency that she created.
And what about the challenges Scott Brown faces? Let's listen to his first TV ad. It includes comments from Leslie Stahl you'll hear from a 60 Minutes profile on him. Let's listen.
Tonight, the independent majority has delivered a great victory.
My whole life has been about beating the odds.
There's absolutely nothing in this world that you can't get if you work hard at it.
I've done what I said I was going to do.
He's turned out to be unpredictably independent.
There you go. Unpredictably independent from Leslie Stahl. And that's where Scott Brown might be in trouble, because he rode in on the Tea Party wave, but he might have angered them by that independence.
Yes, but that helps him in Massachusetts. And I think that's the picture that he wants to paint. The person that isn't predictable, doesn't always march in lockstep with the Democrats, and, you know, will stand up for what he believes in. The issue is, I mean, for Elizabeth Warren, to show, you know, to sort of challenge the idea that he's just such a moderate. You know, after all, he backed the Blunt Amendment, which would have allowed religious groups and others to deny coverage for contraception. He opposed raising taxes for the 1%. You know, she's got to speak to the issues that will resonate with Massachusetts voters that say, hey, maybe this guy isn't just as moderate and you know, the average as you think.
Yeah, on the other hand, he did support some of the new regulations on financial institutions and voted to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So, you know, the columns are filling up on for both candidates, you know, pro and con. Meanwhile, both have agreed not to let the super PACs run negative ads in the race. They actually have this kind of bet, side bet, well, they'll pay each other if this happens. How's that going?
Well, so far it's, you know, I think it's working to his benefit. He's, you know, running a really smart campaign. And again, he's been more effective without super PACs in sort of, you know, kind of chipping away at the story that she's trying to tell and just casting a little bit of doubt and raising questions about someone that Massachusetts doesn't know that much about.
Well, also, he's been sort of casting her as, and people might, you know, outside the state, they might be, you know, scratching their heads on this, but he's casting her as that Harvard professor, which is, you know, a real dig in some parts of the state.
Right, Professor Warren, which I suppose is better than Granny Warren, which Howie Carr calls her in the Boston Herald.
And he's a conservative columnist, yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's another example of just by choice of words, you know, picking words that sort of, you know, sort of resonate with people in a negative way rather than a positive way. And again, I mean, I would just say that the campaign has just not seemed that nimble in countering that.
The Warren campaign. Yep. Well, we'll see how it goes forward. Joan Vinaki, columnist for the Boston Globe, as we continue to take a look at the hot Senate races across the country. Joan, just very briefly, would you agree this is just about the hottest?
It seems like it is, but yeah. we like it hot here.
Yes. Thanks so much, Joan.
Thank you.
Listeners might remember our Thanksgiving Day conversation with Corey Reach and his father, Ted. Corey was diagnosed with ALS just after his 21st birthday. He's now 25. Despite the horribly short lifespan of ALS patients, Corey refuses to let the disease get him down. He and his family have raised over $2 million for ALS research since his diagnosis. Turning Adversity into Advocacy, that's what they do. It's also the name of a group that Corey and Ted are a part of, the San Francisco-based A2A Alliance. As its website says, the group seeks to inspire, educate, and facilitate the process of turning personal challenges into service to others facing personal challenges. Among the members, people looking to raise awareness of lung cancer, obsessive-compulsive disorder, stroke victims. The A2A Alliance is the brainchild of Jeff Bell, who's also the afternoon news anchor at KCBS in San Francisco, and he joins us from there. Jeff, welcome.
Thanks, Robin. So good to be chatting with you.
Well, how we heard of you, we think, is sort of an illustration of how your organization is supposed to work. Michael Jenicke is a doctor who specializes in obsessive-compulsive disorders. He heard Corey, you know, the ALS patient, and his dad, Ted, speak at an event for your organization. Michael told us about them. Then our producer, Emiko Tamagawa, had dinner with Corey and Ted when she was in San Francisco, and they introduced her to you.
You know, this is the best example we can come up with of how A2A works. We're all about trying to leverage the power of shared advocacy. We're finding a lot of folks who are in the ALS community by way of a connection of somebody in their family or someone they know who might have OCD, for example. They're stepping up to the plate and helping those in the OCD community and vice versa.
Well, and you are in the OCD community. Let's talk about that. You were diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder, we understand, in 1993. How did that represent itself?
I had very severe OCD to the point where I could barely leave my house.
Yeah.
I have what's often referred to as reverse contamination issues. I became fixated on this notion that I was unknowingly carrying horrible germs and I was going to expose the world to them and unknowingly hurt people. It's often called harm obsessions. And because of that, at my worst, I couldn't leave the house. I couldn't exchange money with people. It became very problematic. I was fortunate, though, to get help, largely through the organization that Michael Jenicke is a part of, the International OCD Foundation. And as I got better, I found that when I started sharing my story, I published a memoir called Rewind, Replay, Repeat in 1997. And as I got out there and started talking to people, I found that I was becoming stronger and stronger in my own battles. And even more than that, I found that the people I was networking with across all kinds of adversities, cancer and bipolar disorder and lung cancer and so many other different areas, that there was this common thread that those of us who were out doing this adversity-driven advocacy were really finding great personal benefit. I became fascinated by that concept, and I wanted to explore it.
You became a spokesperson for the National OCD Foundation and started A2A. Is this in a way sort of being a warehouse or a clearinghouse?
Absolutely. For example, we find that somebody in, say, the lung cancer community who is doing some great outreach in that community, if we can, through our shared social media and centralized website, present their work to a much broader audience, then we can help them expand their outreach beyond just their own arena.
Yeah.
The second thing that we're doing is that we're trying to provide a path to advocacy for folks who are brand new to it. So we have an A2A alliance on ALS, for example. We have an A2A alliance on OCD and one on bipolar disorder. And these are clusters of our alliance members who are sharing their stories and are providing resources for individuals who are interested in stepping into advocacy, because that's a big part of our mission, is to provide that path. And this allows them to taste advocacy. It allows them to get that sense of empowerment that they will feel when they are able to do something constructive with what they've been through.
It sounds terrific in many ways. On the other hand, I'm just wondering, it feels sometimes as if it is almost a rite of passage now. If you are diagnosed with something, then you must become an advocate. You must organize a walk or have a fundraiser. It's almost as if everyone has to have something, so there's nobody left who's outside of the world of the diagnosis. Do you hear what I'm saying? And do you worry about that there's almost compassion fatigue, but also there's some sense that, well, here's the next step you take and fill in the blank, good things will happen, when in fact, over several decades, we haven't seen much improvement, let's say in ALS and, some of these areas.
I would argue that the real benefit that we're looking to achieve through our organization is at the individual level. We really can't find a cure for ALS, but we can help Corey raise money through Corey's Crusade, the organization that he has founded and has raised, as you said, millions of dollars already. More than that, we are really about trying to help Corey assign some meaning to what he's been through and help him achieve the physiological benefits now of being of service to other people. And I say that, and it's worth circling back to for a moment here, because I think intuitively, Robin, that we would realize that there are psychological benefits to being of service to other people. It makes us feel good. Mm-hmm. But what's so fascinating to me, there are all these studies coming out right now that zero in on the physiological benefits of our giving to other people, of our looking for that sense of purpose. Dacher Keltner, a scientist at UC Berkeley, has explained it to me like this, that when we are in that caring state of mind, we're triggering our vagus nerve. This slows the heart rate. It's almost the opposite of the fight or flight system. Mm. And there are literally physiological benefits to empathy and to service and to finding that sense of purpose that we're looking for.
Well, and even if it's just a psychological benefit, that's invaluable. That's better than medicine for some people.
It can be.
While we have you,
sure.
I'm sitting here thinking of in our studio here, we are all paranoid about germs on keyboards. We all share microphones. How are you handling that now?
Oh, my gosh. Let me tell you, when I did my first book tour, I was at a number of radio stations, and I traveled with my own headphones everywhere.
And this is your book, Rewind, Replay, Repeat, being OCD. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I recently recorded a segment here at Forum in San Francisco, and Michael Krasny's had me on several times, and he noticed as soon as I sat down, he said, "You're using my headphones." And I said, "Yes, I am." And it was a real point of pride for me.
Well, and what's interesting is you've gone from someone who thought you were going to infect other people to someone who has gathered as many people around you as you can.
There is an irony there.
Yeah.
And there was a time, Robin, that and this is very typical for folks with what's called harm OCD, that we're very afraid of offering any kind of advice or any kind of help, because what if we provide the wrong help or wrong advice?
Really?
And that was a real big barrier for me to push through as I went public. And it just seems that through the course of my own evolution of outreach, it's just been one more challenge after another. This is almost one huge exposure therapy project for me. But
how do you give people the news if you're afraid of giving people the wrong?
Yeah, that was a big challenge too. I would go back at my worst, Robin, and I would replay hours of my program to make sure that I got it all right. And not only that I got the news right, but that I actually played the right commercials when I was supposed to. And, oh, I was a mess.
Wow.
I mean, I was really, really a mess. But the flip side of it, and I think you'll appreciate this as well, I also say that radio in a lot of ways saved my life because it's live. And OCD is all about obsessing about what might have happened in the past, what could happen in the future. And for 5 hours a day when I was in that studio, I was, you know, pressed by the nature of what I was doing into focusing on the now.
Yeah.
So it's been an interesting journey.
Wow. That's Jeff Bell, founder of the A2A Alliance. Again, they want to bring people with personal challenges together. He's also the author of several books about his own challenge, obsessive compulsive disorder. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Okay, good to talk to you, Robin.